The Guardian.
Test of emergency alert system capabilities. This test message has been initiated by national alert and warning authorities in coordination with emergency alert system participants, including broadcast, cable, satellite, and wireline participants in your area. Had this been an actual emergency, the attention signal you just heard would have been followed by emergency information, news, or instruction. This is only a test. We now return you to regular programming.
What would you do if an official message popped up on your phone informing you that there was a ballistic missile on its way to wherever you were and urging you to seek shelter right away? On January 13th, 2018, that's what happened to mobile phone users across the state of Hawaii. At about 8:05 on that Saturday morning, an employee at the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency activated an alert code that sent an emergency message to smartphones across the state. It read, in all caps, "Ballistic missile threat inbound to Hawaii. Seek immediate shelter. This is not a drill." We now know that it was, in fact, a drill, and the employee in question had misheard that crucial information. But residents and holidaygoers were left to panic for 38 minutes before they received another alert to let them know the previous one was false. There was no threat. How could a system that had already been used to send 33,000 alerts to people since 2012 get it so wrong this time? Was technology to blame or human error? And what does this bizarre series of events say about our trust in technology at times of crisis?
I'm always a little distrustful of technology in general, just because of the nature of what I do. But in this case, I had no reason to doubt it. It seemed too real. And I think that that's what would drive me next time, is how real the context is.
How come these systems weren't tested enough beforehand so that constraints were built in, that you wouldn't, no one human would be in control of being able to send such a text message to cause such psychological misery?
Welcome to Chips with Everything. I'm Jordan Erica Weber.
Is that right?
Robin Zabrowski is a professor of cognitive science at Beloit College in Wisconsin.
So we were on basically our first family vacation in definitely our first since my kid had been born 3.5 years ago, but basically our first in probably 10 years.
Okay, so then what happened on the morning of January 13th?
So my 3-year-old and my husband were out on the balcony of our hotel just sort of playing. And I was just sitting inside, I think maybe reading a book, and I heard my husband's phone vibrating in a weird way. And so when he walked in the door, I said, "Hey, I think your phone is ringing." And so he picked up the phone and he looked at it, and it was this alert. He showed it to me because I didn't have my phone with me, and he showed it to me and he said, "Is this a," and maybe I shouldn't curse on your podcast, "is this a bleeping joke?" And I went, "Oh my goodness." And basically we sprang into action. I started packing a bag, basically a backpack. I thought, if we were to survive such a missile attack, what would we need to make it through, you know, however many days that we're stuck wherever we are? So I had, bottles of water, bottles of juice, every snack and piece of fruit I could find in our hotel room. I had an iPad to occupy the 3-year-old. I had our phones and chargers, and that's basically it. And we grabbed the kid, got his shoes on, and ran out the door.
What made you believe in what the message was telling you? It doesn't sound like you questioned it at all.
I didn't really. I figured, okay, I'm 2 miles from Pearl Harbor. I've never been to Hawaii before, so I don't know what the norm is. I know they're not getting shot with missiles normally, but for all I know, they are, in fact, used to preparing for this kind of thing. There had been military planes flying overhead since we landed on the island, because there's a military base there. And the possibility that a military base in Hawaii would be struck first just seemed absolutely to make perfect sense.
What kind of information did you have and where did you get it?
I had nothing. And that was the most upsetting part. Everyone was basically using their phones at that moment. So I couldn't get wireless to work. I couldn't really even get the cellular service to work very well. I kept trying to look on Twitter to see what people were saying, because I, you know, that's kind of my first line of defense at this point is where, what do I do? Twitter will tell me. And Twitter wasn't talking about it really.
So how long was it before you realized that the alert was false?
So it came through, we saw it on Twitter before we saw the official alert get pushed out by whoever it is that pushes those alerts out. But it was probably like, it was more than 30 minutes for sure.
When the dust settled, people wanted to know how this had been able to happen. The employee who sent the alert didn't realize it was a drill and has since been fired. But is there a risk something like this could happen again? I spoke to Ian Bogost, a professor of interactive computing at the Georgia Institute of Technology. I started by asking him who was to blame for what happened in Hawaii.
When we found out about the kind of what had really happened, that this was a false alarm, and people started looking at the computer interfaces that the employees at the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency use, they very quickly, a number of people very quickly concluded, well, this is like a user interface design problem. Like, look at this screen. You know, how could you not accidentally click the wrong thing eventually? This is just a user interface design problem. And then others said, well, you know, I don't care what the problem is. This employee is incompetent. We just need to call for his or her head and put someone else in place that's more reliable. Others looked at the system itself, you know, and pointed to the fact that the wireless emergency alert system has been known to be to kind of too narrow band, and they have these proposals I mentioned to increase their capacity. You know, what is very, very hard to admit, much harder to admit than kind of pointing to one of these supposedly obvious solutions, is that it's kind of all of it. And it's very unlikely that we can make one small change to a system like this that then results in sort of more reliable, more credible alerts in the first place. So I think we just have to be very, very careful to draw immediate and simplistic conclusions about a system like this, even if there are things that can clearly be improved across every register of the way that the system works.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the alerts themselves. Can you give a kind of quick explanation of how the emergency alerts work?
Right. So just by a very quick background here, these emergency alert systems have been around since the mid-20th century, and they were originally developed to notify the public in the event of war, specifically of a nuclear calamity. And the main purpose originally was not to sort of say, hey, you should take shelter, there might be, you know, hydrogen bombs incoming. But rather to communicate the state of the government, and in the case that there had been a disruption or a change in leadership, to make sure that people knew what was taking place, who was in charge, and what to do next. That was in the 1950s when these things were first set up. By the 60s, they had been redeveloped and advanced into a system called the Emergency Broadcast System, or EBS, here in the United States. And that was around 1963 when that was set up. And those are the things that Cold War kids will remember, these sort of like blaring high-pitched noises on the television or radio when they tested the system. So this is a test of the emergency broadcast system. And, you know, as that developed and it was used for decades until the late 1990s, it became clear that, wow, you know, in addition to notifying the public about the possibility of nuclear calamity, these things also have other uses. We can communicate about less urgent emergencies that nevertheless have the need to get into the hands and heads of the public, things like weather disasters, natural disasters. And then by the early 2000s, was integrated with itself largely as a result of what was perceived to be a failure in preparedness and response after Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. And so we got this system called the Integrated Public Alert and Warning System.
So as you've said that the systems have evolved over time in response to things like the failure of preparedness after Hurricane Katrina, do you think that the system will change now as a result of this?
So the system is certainly changing. We already know some of the ways that the FCC wants to change the wireless alerts, but there were already proposals in place before this event to change, especially the wireless alert system. Those included lengthening the messages themselves. They can only be 90 characters now, and there's a proposal to increase them to about 350 characters, I believe. There's also been an kind of agitation among local emergency management agencies to be able to test wireless alerts better than they're able to now. So there's definitely an understanding that these systems are evolutionary, that they need to improve and that they can improve. Although we should be careful about proposals that seem to suggest that there's a simple answer and we know what it is and we just have to roll it out.
So what do you think we've learned from this situation about kind of society and its relationship with technology and its reaction to it in a crisis?
One thing we've learned is that the internet has globalized everything. It's globalized information. And so when there is information that is most useful and most urgently used in a local community, it's very hard to keep it in that local community, especially when it's incredibly sensitive. That sounds like a great thing, and it has historically sounded like a great thing, because now you can take events that take place anywhere in the world and spread them very quickly. But it also can be really terrible, because often what needs to happen in an emergency is that a local community needs to be left alone for a while to kind of deal with what's going on and to operate at a scale that can service its local constituency without being bombarded by kind of cross information or traffic from others. So, this sort of dream of the global village that the internet has created is also kind of a nightmare. And what we do about that is hard to say. Another thing we've learned is that the absence, or at least the decay of local media channels has had an impact on the way that people collect information. And now, it's easy to get anything you want to hear online, but at the same time, it's much, much harder to get credible, current information about what's going on in a local community. So we've really kind of degraded and narrowed the information channel, not just by pressing it through these short-form messages, but also by relying on them, their frequency, and the kind of volume with which we send them. We're constantly expecting to be connected in that way. That might be a situation that changes, that already has changed, the way that people are even capable of responding to an emergency or to an urgent situation that they might have to think about and act on very rapidly.
As Ian points out, humans have come to rely on the information we get from machines, perhaps without always knowing what to do with that information. So what happens when the technology we rely on has sent us the wrong information? And why do we trust machines so much in the first place?
It is we start off with the basis of trusting others and systems, believing they have been built with accuracy, timeliness, that kind of thing. And humans involved in designing those systems would have built-in constraints to ensure that errors aren't made by the human.
That's something we'll look into after this short break. We'll also ask Robin, who you heard at the start of this episode, how this false alert has affected her trust in the system.
I would definitely question it.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Welcome to The Start, a brand new weekly podcast from The Guardian.
Without those kind of engaging with reality, I will not become I will be today.
Each episode reveals a story of artistic beginnings, as told by some of the great artists of our time.
For me, Scandalicious, so much of that was also about me finding my way.
Focusing on one piece, they share how these early moments of creativity shaped them, the influence it had on their subsequent work, and what the piece now means to them in retrospect.
The most I've ever seen in any room, looking at any kind of art, was in Mr. Barnes's two rooms.
To find out more, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search The Start on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back to Chips with Everything. I'm Jordan Erica Weber. Before the break, we looked at what happened when a false ballistic missile alert was sent out to people on the islands of Hawaii at the start of 2018. We heard from Ian Bogost, who unpacked emergency alert systems and gave us some insight on what could prevent something like this from happening again. But as technology continues to develop, humans find themselves relying on machines more and more in their day-to-day lives.
Well, I would say we've become independent since we started using the stick in the sand to draw and divide. So we've always used technologies to enhance, to explain, to clarify. So in that respect, I feel we've always been using technologies. For example, without these glasses, I can't read small text in front of me. So I think, yes, we are dependent on technologies.
To dig a little deeper into our relationship with technology, I sat down with Dr. Huma Shah, who teaches at the School of Computing, Electronics and Maths at Coventry University, and is the author of the book, Turing's Imitation Game, Conversations with the Unknown. So why do you think we humans are so willing to trust machines then?
I think we humans believe others are like us. So the trust is, it is subjective, and it is we start off with the basis of trusting others and systems, believing they have been built with accuracy, timeliness, that kind of thing. And humans involved in designing those systems would have built-in constraints to ensure that errors aren't made by the human. You know, for example, controls on cookers, controls on all sorts of gadgets will have been hopefully designed for protecting the human user. So we would trust in those systems that they're designed in a way not to damage us, cause us psychological misery.
So in Hawaii, the false missile alert was down to human error, but people are still questioning the technology involved in the system. And when people feel like they've been failed by machines, what happens to that trust in technology?
First of all, there would be, I have not talked to those people. I would love to access the people, but really, I believe they would be quite shocked in that how come these systems weren't tested enough beforehand so that constraints were built in, that you wouldn't, no one human would be in control of being able to send such a text message to cause such psychological misery. Because it isn't just, oh, well, sorry, we made an error and it took us whatever time, 38 minutes or whatever it was, to put it right. It's a psychological misery in that time to put things right, where people could have been, you know, considering suicide or whatever. Or one case I heard where a father was trying to decide which child to go to because they were spread across the island, which one should they choose? That kind of psychological misery for that human being, that father, they would question, well, how is it? It's not just the technology, but how has it been designed that the technology would not have constraints on it? So it's not just trust in the system, but it's trust in the designers of the system.
You said that you think that people start from a position of trust. And do you think that an event like this will have affected that? Do you think that the people who experience this false alert will no longer start from that position of trust?
Yes, I believe so. Because if you start from a position of trust and then that trust is damaged by a real visceral experience, then you've now got distrust. So what's going to happen? It's like the man who cried wolf. What happens if there is a real threat? How are those people going to trust that text message? With this error now, how are they going to trust and act in such a way to for their survival and protect their things if it were possible to survive? So yes, so now distrust has been built in. And not just in Hawaii. People who will have read about it all over are going to distrust as well.
Mm. Do you think it's risky to rely on this kind of technology, especially because we rely on them more and more every day?
The problem is the human memory is it's not that, doesn't have the capacity of a machine like IBM Watson. So we have to rely on systems to bring us up-to-date information. It also is quicker to ask a system to bring us information because we might have to do quite a few things at the same time. So we don't have time to search. There's risk in every kind of technology. I mean, like people have said, a knife, you can use a knife to spread butter or to cause damage. It's risk that we take every day, like crossing the road, coming here, everything we do, risk is involved, and we will measure, we will assess risk before we perform any activity. So we have to balance the risk, but what happens is we balance the risk with necessity, speed, convenience.
Robin, if you were ever to receive a message like that on your phone again, what would you think? Would you trust it?
I think context matters a lot. And again, the whole suite of things in Hawaii, the fact that it was my first visit, the fact that I was, you know, a few miles from Pearl Harbor, the fact that there were military planes everywhere, it all made it seem perfectly reasonable. I feel like if I got such an alert on my phone right now, I'm in kind of the middle of nowhere in Wisconsin, I would definitely question it. I would definitely wonder why on earth anyone would be bombing Wisconsin, you know, unless it was my own government testing our missiles or something, because, you know, we're not an important target in any way. And so I would question it based on where I am and what the context is. But if I were in Hawaii and saw such a message again, I would roll my eyes and then I would spring right back into action. I would probably trust it because the risk is too great not to.
I'd like to thank Ian Bogost, Dr. Huber Shah, and Robin Zabrowski for joining me this week. You can find a link to Dr. Shah's book in the description for this episode on the Guardian website. If you have any questions, queries, or feedback, get in touch via our email address, guardianchips@gmail.com. And please let us know if you have any cool digital stories you think we should know about. I'm Jordan Erica Weber. See you next time.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.